From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now. Happy Thanksgiving. A summit in Brussels today between European Union leaders and Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko is tackling a number of contentious issues, including human rights concerns and Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea. Also, the issue of corruption. Poroshenko's critics say he has not done enough to rid his country of it. For more on that and conditions in Ukraine, we're joined by the BBC's Tom Burridge in Kiev. And Tom, first, why the crackdown on government corruption here? What's at stake?
Well, if you think back to 2014, protesters 3 years ago took to the streets. They did so because the pro-Russian president then, Viktor Yanukovych, turned his back on the European Union. They forced Mr. Yanukovych from power. He went to Russia. He's still there. Then you've got this new political order, if you like, and they signed a deal with the European Union. Ukraine's side of the bargain is they have to reform. They have to get the country functioning in a more transparent, less corrupt, efficient way. And in return, they get lots of money from the European Union and from the United States and lots of support.
So another big issue that will be on the table today in Brussels, the future of sanctions against Russia, which are set to expire at the end of January. Any chance that the EU will let those lapse?
Well, look, I think sanctions will probably get renewed from the European Union. There's two lots of sanctions, one for Russia's annexation of Crimea and the others linked to the war in the east of Ukraine called the Donbass, where pro-Russian separatists are fighting the Ukrainian military. I think, generally speaking, EU sanctions will be renewed. There are differences of tone, though, on EU policy, European policy towards Russia and Ukraine, and the two are interlinked, of course. Countries in the south of Europe, some in the east, Hungary, Italy, maybe, Greece, they are more pro the European Union working to form some kind of rapprochement with Russia. There isn't one voice on Europe on this, but the European member states obviously have different positions, but I still think the sanctions will go through.
Well, here's another voice, perhaps one losing some of its influence. Last week, President Obama was in Europe and spoke about America's relationship with Russia. Here he is.
On issues like Ukraine, on issues like Syria, we've had very significant differences. And my hope is that the president-elect coming in takes a similarly constructive approach.
Tom Burridge, how much of the EU's policy depends on the political picture here in the United States? As we know, Obama is leaving office and President-elect Trump has promised to cozy up with Russia, promised to normalize relations. How is that influencing the EU policymakers?
If Donald Trump changes U.S. policy towards Ukraine, I think it won't necessarily change European Union policy on Ukraine. I think European Union policy, in a way, if that happened, would become more resolute. But of course, it depends on the internal politics and it depends what happens in the French elections, the German elections next year. But going back to the United States, what was interesting coming out today was that Petro Poroshenko, the Ukrainian president, gave new details about his recent phone call with Donald Trump. And he actually said that they did discuss Russia's annexation of Crimea and what the Ukrainian president calls Russian aggression, the actions of Russia in the east of Ukraine too. It was interesting that he said that because, you know, there is a sort of a theory going around that maybe Donald Trump, under pressure from a more, you know, his more traditional Republican colleagues who would like the US to remain hardline against Russia, might actually not follow through with his rhetoric. There is a sort of theory that actually on Crimea, what we might not hear is the same kind of rhetoric that we heard from Vice President Biden. You know, when he was in Ukraine not that long ago and addressed the parliament here, he was pretty resolute in his language, saying that the United States will never recognize what he deems as Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea. It'll be interesting to see whether Donald Trump ever comes out with that kind of language.
But is there a sense where you are there in Ukraine that Trump's election might make Vladimir Putin feel energized and maybe feel like he can be more aggressive in the region? I mean, how are people feeling there in Ukraine?
Well, look, that's the fear. I think what you're getting from advisors close to the president to us is saying, well, they're trying to play this down. You know, they're trying to say, well, look, the Republican establishment are going to rein Trump in. That's what they hope, really. Donald Trump did come out with some pretty controversial comments over Ukraine, suggested that he might consider you know, recognizing Russia's annexation of Crimea. At one stage in that ABC interview, also saying that he wasn't quite sure whether Russian troops had been involved in the conflict in the east of Ukraine. So there is worry here in Kiev, but I think they're playing it down and just hoping, and obviously working all the diplomatic channels, trying to basically lobby the Trump team as much as possible in the run-up to him taking office to maintain, you know, the pressure so that he does keep the US policy as it is on Ukraine.
The BBC's Tom Burridge in Kiev. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Well, as 2016 winds down, a lot of Americans are trying to figure out which charities to support. It can be a tough decision when there are so many competing needs. Amy Costello spends a lot of time thinking about this. She's the founder and managing editor of Tiny Spark, a podcast that reports on philanthropy and nonprofits. Amy, welcome back.
Great to be here, Peter.
Where are people giving these days?
I would say, you know, people are giving generally where they always have. About a third of charitable giving every year in the United States tends to go to religious institutions, about 16% to education, you know, universities and all of that. And, you know, the next biggest chunk of money goes to human services, so things that are helping people in need. But, you know, the thing that has struck me most about this sector is the fact that I interviewed one guy who headed up Charity Navigator, which is the, you know, largest charity evaluator in the country. And he said that 85% of the money flowing through the nonprofit sector goes to about 1% of the nation's charities. And what that means is that the vast majority of small nonprofits doing good work in this country, working on the ground in the communities where your listeners live, have a very hard time attracting donor dollars. And so another thing to think about is there a nonprofit right in your neighborhood that you think is doing good work? Chances are they really need your money and that most of those dollars are going to more well-known national organizations like the Red Cross and others.
There's another thing in the business called effective altruism, and that's where people try to give to a cause that's going to do the most good that it possibly can. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of us, when we're going to write a check to a charitable cause, you want to know, you know, how much impact is this going to have? And can my dollar do the most good with certain organizations or other ones? And effective altruism basically says your dollar can go farthest if it is given to a cause in a developing nation, to children who are hungry, to children living in poverty in Africa or Latin America. That will do much more good than donating to a U.S. cause, such as maybe a homeless shelter here in Detroit, because your dollar just simply doesn't go as far there. And the people aren't really as in need as maybe a hungry child in Malawi.
And what about this idea that just a little bit of money can go a long way? Not everybody can afford a big gift around the holidays. Do you have some examples of what just a few bucks can do if it goes to the right place? I'm thinking a couple dollars might buy a mosquito net to stop malaria.
Yeah. And, you know, for those who are interested in giving abroad, I have interviewed on my program a guy who from an organization called The Life You Can Save, and it's thelifeyoucansave.org. And they've actually vetted a number of charities that work abroad, where for really a very small amount of money, you can have cataracts removed from someone's eyes. You can get, you know, eyeglasses to them. You can provide nutritional supplements, you know, things of that nature. So very high impact, low cost initiatives through charities that have been through some kind of vetting process. Mm. And then for those who are interested in giving domestically, there are some sites that review charities such as Charity Navigator. But the problem with those kinds of sites is that they don't measure impact. So you can hear about their financials, their transparency, but very difficult on a site like Charity Navigator to determine whether that, you know, agency is actually effective in the work that they do. Another one is GiveWell. They also vet a number of charities and rate them on their effectiveness. And another one, finally, I'll just throw in there is GiveDirectly, which has gotten a lot of play for giving cash directly to the poor and letting them decide what to do with it.
You pose a question in one of your podcasts. You actually suggest asking for people who might be concerned about whether or not their money is going to the right place. You suggest they ask, what would happen in your community if you went out of business tomorrow? You think people should actually do that? That's helpful.
Yeah, I think one of the guests I interviewed said that that's a very useful question to ask a nonprofit. And I think what that says is how meaningful are they really in the lives of the people that they're trying to help? And so a good sign of an organization is one that is working in very close partnership with the community, tackling problems that the community itself has identified as something that they want to tackle.
And where do we stand on transparency? Lots of concerns about whether or not that money's being spent well. What can people do to vet the charities that they're giving to?
You know, transparency is one thing that the organization Charity Navigator does rate charities on as to whether they are transparent with their financials and how they're spending their money. But even then, there is great debate within the nonprofit sector about whether overhead, for instance, is a meaningful way to judge a nonprofit. Lots of donors say, oh, I don't want a charity to have a lot of high overhead. I don't want them to pay executives a lot of money. I don't want to pay for new computer systems. But in fact, many very well-run charities do have high overhead. And the more important question to ask is, are they having the impact that they say that they're having? And that overhead shouldn't necessarily be a meaningful way to evaluate an organization.
All right. Something to think about on this Thanksgiving. Amy Costello, founder and managing editor of the podcast Tiny Spark. Amy, thank you. Happy holidays.
You too, Peter.
This is an important day for fans of the band.
Up on Cripple Creek, as she sends me, if I spring a leap, as she bends me, I don't have to speak, as she defends me, a drunkard's dream, if I ever did see one.
It was Thanksgiving night in San Francisco, 1976, when A-list musicians like Bob Dylan, Neil Young, Van Morrison, and Emmylou Harris joined the band on stage for their farewell concert. It was called The Last Waltz. The show was filmed by director Martin Scorsese, who released a documentary about it 2 years later. And 4 decades later, the performances still resonate. Bill Janovitz plays in the band Buffalo Tom. He also writes about music. His books include Rocks Off, 50 Tracks That Tell the Story of the Rolling Stones, and he's with us now in studio. Bill, let's talk about this concert. There had been other big shows before. Woodstock, 1969, of course, comes to mind. But what made The Last Waltz so special?
The idea was that they were going to get off the road, the band. They had been a seminal act for a lot of people because they came along during the psychedelic era and they brought music back to its roots, you know. So it was all this old, weird American music, as Grail Marcus characterized it. So they were a really important band. They were a band's band. And, you know, so you have this redundancy of a band's band named the band.
Well, in fact, the story is that Bob Dylan called them the band because, and that just kind of stuck. They were just so, as you say, the band's band, and the name stuck. Well, let's listen to some music here. This is the band playing The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down, a classic.
The night they drove old Dixie down, when all the bells are ringing. The night they drove old Dixie down, and all the people.
So, Bill, the San Francisco music critic Joel Selvin told the San Jose Mercury News that this was by far and away the best night of music that he's ever seen, with nothing in second place and 10 shows tied for third. What would you say was so special about the music that night?
Well, I mean, you have to start with the band themselves, who were a real democratic unit. So you've got the only songwriter basically in the band was Robbie of the band's material. I mean, they all went on to write their own material, but in the band, I mean, if you look through all of their classic songs and pretty much all their non-classic songs, it's Robbie Robertson, and that's arguable what the other guys brought to the songs. But so you've got him, but he's not a singer really, but you've got these other three, like, first-class singers, like, that are able to sing in three-part harmonies or solo, and they're basically three lead vocalists that all could lead any band and be up there with some of the greatest singers in rock and roll. So you've got them as the backing band. First, they do their own set, and then they start bringing out the top echelon of music that sort of had come from the 60s.
Exactly. We've got Bob Dylan, who was there. He played several of his songs, including this one, Forever Young.
May God bless and keep you always. May your wishes all come true. May you always do for others and let others do for you.
What was the significance of Bob Dylan's role at this concert? Because he had a long-standing relationship with these guys.
Yeah, I mean, when Bob went electric, he kind of pieced together a road act to take the songs out on the road. And then Robbie Robertson himself, if not a couple of other guys, went back in to play with him on Blonde on Blonde down in Nashville. Primarily his biggest foil and collaborator of the band was Robbie Robertson. And they really helped him evolve, and sort of through that whole getting off the roller coaster thing where he, you know, the post-motorcycle crash, Bob Dylan up in Woodstock, holes up with these guys, and really in a very rudimentary home recording setup, recorded some really important music. And then they helped him transition into the 70s, and likewise, they became their own seminal act, as I said, putting out at least two Stone classic records and some others that are considered classics as well.
Well, there were so many A-list artists there, but one of them, there were some questions about why he was there. It was Neil Diamond. Here, let's listen to Neil Diamond play his song Dry Your Eyes.
Dry your eyes, take your song out when it's a newborn afternoon. And if you can't recall the singer, can you still recall the tune? Dry your eyes, play it slowly, just like you're marching off to war. Sing it like you always wanted, like you sung it once before.
So this is a rich, emotional song, and I love this story because Levon Helm wrote in his memoir that when he was backstage when this concert was getting started, he saw Neil Diamond there, and he said to the other guys, why is Neil Diamond here?
Yeah.
It's almost like he didn't fit necessarily the feeling of the band. So why was he at the concert?
Well, it was it had to do with having the same manager, I believe, and Their mutual manager had Robbie producing that song on an album, I think, of Neil Diamond's songs. And Robbie's whole sort of, I feel like he sort of goes out of his way to explain how Neil Diamond fits in. And if you have to go out of your way to explain, then there's something wrong here. But he says that, you know, he represented the Tin Pan Alley era of songwriting, which is an important part of popular music, obviously, in the 50s and 60s. And Neil did come out of that stable of Carole King and, you know, that whole sort of school of writing.
And Neil Diamond killed it on stage. I mean, that's thought of as a very well-respected song. He only played it that one time, has never played it again, the war protest song.
I think of Neil Diamond as, and I have a high tolerance for shtick, but I feel like he's on the other side. I mean, there's certainly some songs of his that I absolutely love, but I mean, there's some other things that were. It was a wide and varied night. I didn't love Joni Mitchell when I was a kid, but I've certainly come to appreciate her more. But that was a bit of a weird appearance too, with her behind the curtain. They didn't want to spoil. The thing is, the audience at this concert didn't know who was going to be there.
Really? Yeah, they tried to keep it secret.
It was unannounced, and the band themselves didn't. I mean, the band didn't know if Dylan was going to show up and if he was going to go on and then if he was going to be filmed. You know, Bob keeps them guessing. And there was a lot of controversy over that. But Neil Diamond, you know, Muddy Waters. Jeez.
Oh, I mean, that's great.
That's,
yeah.
Yeah, you've got an amazing list of people.
Woo! Now, when I was a young boy, at the age of 5, my mother said, I'm going to be the greatest man alive. But now I'm a man way past 21. I want you to leave me, woman. I have lots of fun.
Well, they also played a song that you've covered yourself with your own band. It Makes No Difference. Let's hear a little bit of that.
It
Like that song. I mean, all this music, it just sort of like takes you back to a certain time, a certain place in one's life. I mean, let's close out with, you know, what it is that you'll remember when you think back on The Last Waltz 40 years on.
Well, it was an authenticity. I mean, that's the word that would always go with the band. But you hear right there just the opening vocal lines from Rick Danko, who was just one of three singers who sang with that sort of same level of commitment to the lyric and emotional. And I think it was that sort of passion and the real feeling that actually ultimately meant the band had to eventually end and around that time. I mean, these guys were in pain, a lot of them. I mean, Richard Manuel famously hung himself after a night of drinking and cocaine in a cheesy little motel in Florida. I mean, in 86, I believe. It kind of was the premonition that Robbie had with getting these guys off the road to begin with.
There were five members of the band. Three of them have passed away. But Robbie Robertson, who is still living, said that we had such an incredible thing to achieve. In the whole night, in the whole five-hour concert, we never screwed up. That was an accomplishment that belongs in the Guinness Book of World Records, which I think says something about the quality of the music that night. Bill Janovitz from the band Buffalo Tom. He's been speaking with us about the 40th anniversary of The Last Waltz. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Blue Apron knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals, so they follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week by Blue Apron's culinary team, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. There's no weekly commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/here.
More than 48 million Americans will be traveling more than 50 miles this Thanksgiving. According to AAA, it hasn't been that busy since 2007. Of course, that's good news for the airline industry, which has recently won over a longtime skeptic. Berkshire Hathaway CEO Warren Buffett has decided to plow more than $1 billion into airlines. Kurt Nikisch is senior editor at Harvard Business Review. Hi, Kurt.
Hey, Peter.
Well, explain what happened, because there was a time when Warren Buffett said the airlines were a bottomless pit.
Yeah, he called it a death trap sector. He blamed the low profitability on kamikaze pricing tactics. And he joked that he was an aeroholic. You know, he got burned when he put money into U.S. Airways and lost a bunch. And he said that he'd set up a toll-free number that he could call if he was ever tempted to invest in airlines again. But here he is investing $1.2 billion in not just one airline, but the four largest U.S. airlines.
What does he see in them?
Well, he sees a different airline industry. He sees an industry where airlines have merged, so there aren't as many of them competing with each other. He sees airlines that have cut back on seats and capacity, so they're able to sort of raise prices on limited supply and keep planes full. And so the airline industry, which used to lose a lot of money year after year, now it's making record profits.
Okay, so lots of changes in the airline industry. You mentioned the mergers, specifically U.S. Airways and American in 2013. That's been good for the industry, but Harvard Business Review has looked at another factor that's helping the airlines, and that's who owns them. What'd you learn?
Yeah, so this is really interesting. If you look at who are the largest shareholders of the top four U.S. airlines, that's United, Delta, American, and Southwest, it's actually the same companies. Like Vanguard, for instance, which is a big mutual fund company, a large asset manager, It's among the top three shareholders in all four of those airlines. And if you look down the list, you'll see the same names, Fidelity, State Street, T. Rowe Price. And so if you own United, but you also own Delta and the other two, well, it's not really in your interest to see one of them compete aggressively against the other because you'd rather see them all kind of holding prices up.
Okay, well, that sounds terrible if you want to buy a plane ticket.
Yeah, that's very troubling for consumers because you don't know, you know, right now you don't see an incentive for one airline to really start like cutting prices and trying to go after market share of other airlines because you know that the owners aren't necessarily encouraging it. The other thing is, this is not just the airline industry. This new trend of what's called common ownership is something that's actually in a lot of industries. Research has shown how banks are owned by many of the same companies. So this is not just something that affects the airline industry, but could affect really industries across the board.
Does that mean looking down the road at the airline industry? I mean, they're enjoying fat times right now. Do they expect them to last under these conditions?
There could be some things that could come with a new presidential administration. Deregulation, which might allow new entrants into the market, maybe more foreign carriers allowed to do business in the United States. And then, of course, there are oil prices and cost of labor and everything else. But for now, things look pretty good for the airline industry.
Kurt Nikisch is senior editor at the Harvard Business Review. Kurt, thank you very much.
You got it.
South Carolina is reliving some difficult moments in its past. Two racially charged court cases are moving through the system. Former North Charleston police officer Michael Slager is on trial, accused of fatally shooting an unarmed black man named Walter Scott in April 2015. The other case involves Dylan Roof, charged with killing nine black worshippers in the Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston last June. Roof had been pictured wearing symbols of white supremacy, and the killings sparked a debate over the Confederate flag in South Carolina. The state legislature even voted to take the flag down at the state house. Around that time, we spoke to journalist Christopher Dickey about his book, Our Man in Charleston, Britain's Secret Agent in the Civil War South, which is now out in paperback. And a lot of these themes came up. I started by asking him to tell me about Robert Bunch, the British consul who served in South Carolina from 1853 to 1863.
He went there because he thought it might be kind of a good career move for a young and up-and-coming diplomat. But once he got there and saw the conditions of slavery and listened to the people around him talking about the way they treated the slaves, he became passionately opposed to the institution. But he didn't tell anybody because he had to make nice with all those people, all those slave owners, all the elite of Charleston. And he did better than that. He ingratiated himself with all of them. All the while, over 10 years, he was writing secret and confidential dispatches and private letters back to the Foreign Office in London and to the ambassadors, the British ambassadors in Washington, D.C. And he was telling them exactly how horrible it was and telling them also that the South was going to secede eventually, that it would expect Britain to support it, and that should not and could not ever happen.
So Robert Bunch was essentially a secret agent and he was reporting what he found back to Britain. How did that influence the way Britain saw the war?
Well, theoretically, Britain was very much against slavery, but it had learned to live with Southern slavery, which raised 80% of the cotton in British mills. Where it drew a red line, where the Crown drew a red line, was about the question of the slave trade with Africa, which had been banned since 1807 by Britain and also by the United States. Slaves had gotten so incredibly valuable in the South by the 1850s that there was a huge push to reopen the slave trade with Africa. And if the South had done that, and there were many people saying that the South would do that, many Southerners saying they would do that, then that would have wrecked everything, all prospects for recognition by Britain. Eventually, Bunch convinced London that no matter what the Southerners said, they were going to do that as soon as they got the chance. And that is one of the things that stopped the British from giving the South the absolutely vital recognition it needed.
And we kind of forget that Britain had a complicated role in the Civil War and that it had a lot of interest, as you say, in the South.
Well, it did. And there were a lot of reasons that the Southerners had believed when they declared that they would break away from the Union that, of course, London would back them. London got all its cotton or so much of its cotton from them. London, a lot of the elite in London really didn't like the whole Republican, small-R Republican experiment in the United States. And they deluded themselves into thinking that it was a sure bet, that it would be game over as soon as they seceded. But that didn't happen, and Robert Bunch is one of the reasons why.
And whatever happened to him?
You know, eventually, he ingratiated himself so much with the Southern elite that the Union Secretary of State, William Seward, concluded that Bunch really was working for British recognition of the South. And he did everything he could to get Bunch expelled. The British wouldn't do it. But finally, they pulled Bunch out just as Charleston came under heavy siege in 1863. And eventually, he became the ambassador to Colombia and to Venezuela.
Let's bring this back to the modern day and the conversation that we've been having about the history of the war. And you've talked about the false histories that we tell ourselves about the Civil War. What do you mean by that? And how does this book address that?
Well, look, Peter, the big false history, and you still hear it argued all the time in the South, is that the Civil War was not, between quotes, about slavery. Oh, hell yeah, it was about slavery. Here's exactly how it happened, and you can tweet it out. The South seceded to protect the institution of slavery, and the North went to war to stop secession. That is how the war started. Eventually, by 1863, it became a crusade against slavery. But it wasn't in the beginning. But had there been no issue of slavery, there would have been no war.
So what do you make of the controversy that we've been having over the Confederate battle flag after the shootings in Charleston, South Carolina? You're a son of the South. What do you make of all this?
Well, I think people totally misunderstood and misunderstand what that battle flag has come to represent. When Robert E. Lee, whose battle flag it was, surrendered at Appomattox, that battle flag was furled and the war was over for him. That flag came out again with a vengeance as a reaction to the civil rights movement, starting in the 40s and building through the 50s and 60s. That was the flag not to honor the Civil War dead. That was a flag to say no to civil rights, held up in defiance by white people, for white people, in memory of people who didn't die, for the most part, defending slavery. They were sucked into the war by the elite slave owners. But once the war was started, they were dying to defend their homes and families, they thought. But the flag, that's all about racism.
Christopher, Chris, I want to ask you then, is there a way that we can appropriately honor the memory of the Confederate war dead if the battle over the Confederate flag is seemingly lost in South Carolina?
Well, I think, first of all, we do have to understand that hundreds of thousands of men and women died in the South in that war because they were led into it by an elite that was protecting its own very narrow interests, using its money, its power over the press, its power over the courts to do that. And then I think we have to say, were those people complete fools? No, they were deluded like people who were led into war all the time, many wars, even wars that have been fought in the last few years. So I think we just have to say, look, they fought bravely. They died bravely in many cases. They died for the wrong cause. But we shouldn't insult their memories just because some racists in the 1950s and 60s wanted to wave one of their flags.
So in that case, would you say that some sort of monument would be appropriate?
I think many of the monuments are. I think you have to look at them individually. Some of them are not. But in fact, I think most of those small town monuments to the Confederate dead throughout the South should stand where they are.
This is all very personal to you, this history. Your uncle Tom used to hunt for Civil War shells and cannonballs, and you made a film about him. And at the end of this film, we see him defusing an old shell, which, by the way, is very dangerous work, some 150 years after the war. And he lights the powder, actually. Let's listen to some of that.
I do worry about it some, because if this house caught on fire, it could do a lot of damage around the neighborhood. You'd see, you'd hear the last shots fired during the Civil War.
That is quite an image. But you're still hearing the last shots of the Civil War. I guess, in a way, it seems appropriate, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, because we're still hearing in different ways the last shots fired in the Civil War. In one horrible way, we heard those shots fired in Charleston a few weeks ago. No, I think that my Uncle Tom was a charming guy, but his view of the war was all about armaments and munitions and being a collector. The real view that we have to have of the war is that it was fought for the interests of a very small group of people protecting their right to own slaves. And a lot of people who otherwise would not have been killed had to fight and die in that conflict.
You know, 150 years after the war, though, it seems like a very long time. I mean, what do you think? Will it take another 150 for those shots to be silenced? Or what does it take in the South for the legacy of the Civil War to? Will it ever go away?
Well, I think the reaction to the murders in Charleston certainly is a turning point in the way people think and talk about these issues. It's not an old man with a gray beard and a Confederate cap waving the flag saying, forget hell. No, it's not that anymore. I think we've had to look at it very seriously. And at the same time, I think we have to recognize that the South is changing really dramatically and that the scars left by the war, some of the scars left by slavery, and some of the scars left by the occupation by the North of the South after the war, those are fading now as the South picks itself up and moves on.
Chris Dickey's book is Our Man in Charleston, Britain's Secret Agent in the Civil War South. It's out in paperback. We spoke in 2015. Many American families are celebrating three things today: home, Thanksgiving, and football. But it hasn't always been that way. Karen Given, with our colleagues down the hall at NPR's Only a Game, explains the connection between football and Turkey Day.
Come on, Charlie Brown. I'll hold the ball and you kick it.
I did not grow up with football, but I did grow up with Charlie Brown. So when I first saw this scene from 1973's A Charlie Brown Thanksgiving, I'm pretty sure I thought Lucy was pulling Charlie Brown's leg again.
Well, one of the greatest traditions we have is the Thanksgiving Day football game. And the biggest, most important tradition of all is the kicking off of the football. Is that right?
Is that right? And why did football and Thanksgiving come to be linked? I asked Richard Crapeau. He's a professor of history at the University of Central Florida, and he specializes in sports history and 20th century U.S. history.
In the colonial period, the concept of Thanksgiving was essentially a thanks for a harvest or thanks for a military victory, thanks for something that went right.
Those Thanksgivings weren't a celebration of the home. They were a solemn church affair where colonists spent hours, sometimes all day, sitting on hard church pews. Historian James Baker was the longtime director of research for the Living History Museum, Plymouth Plantation, so he knows a thing or two about pilgrims. So I asked him, would pilgrims have enjoyed football on Thanksgiving?
No. The pilgrims probably wouldn't have approved of it.
The pilgrims did not approve of sports or leisure or fun, but
even King James, who liked sports, told his son Henry, who died, that he should avoid football. Other sports were right. Football is more for laming, he said, than exercise.
Over time, opinions about the benefits of long hours in church pews and the dangers of football softened, and Thanksgivings, celebrations of family and home, were being held on a semi-regular basis. Decades later, President Abraham Lincoln declared Thanksgiving a national holiday. The year was 1863. I grew up thinking of this as a Christmas song. So what's it doing in the middle of a story about Thanksgiving and football? And I am getting back to the football, I promise you. So if you don't already know, this isn't really a Christmas song. It's a Thanksgiving song. Here's James Baker again.
The original was, you know, over the river and through the woods, the grandfather's house, because it was the patriarch of the family that was inviting everybody.
And this is where football comes to the rescue, because with Thanksgiving moving out of the church, a male realm, and into the home where women ruled, some scholars suggest that men were starting to get a bit concerned about their place in this holiday of turkey and pumpkin pie. I ran this idea by Dr. Crapeau, and he agreed.
If you go back to the late 19th century, one of the great sort of social anxieties that one reads about in that period is a concern over the feminization of culture.
Luckily, college football came along at just the right time.
Football in general, it's so identified with masculinity. And masculinity is so central to all the rituals around it and to the game itself, that the introduction of that into a national holiday, it certainly masculinizes the holiday itself.
The first college football game was held in 1874. It wouldn't be long before the sport found a home on Thanksgiving Day.
The Princeton versus Yale game became the first sort of traditional established one.
At one point in the mid-90s...
That's the 1890s.
The football advisor at Yale decided that perhaps it was time to focus it on Thanksgiving.
It just sort of took off from there.
They were playing at the Polo Grounds in New York. It was drawing about 40,000 fans.
It was something that people would go out and do on Thanksgiving. When you got through dinner and you didn't know what else to do with your guests, you'd take them to a football game.
Very quickly, that idea of a Thanksgiving game, football game, spread out of New York, out of the Yale-Princeton rivalry, and spread across the country. And by the mid to late 90s...
Again, the 1890s.
There were maybe 5,000 Thanksgiving Day football games going on across the country.
Then, in 1934, the NFL joined the Thanksgiving Day party with a tradition that brought the holiday back into the home.
The owner of the Lions, George Richards, he also had an interest in a radio station in Detroit, and he was able to put together a network of 94 stations coast to coast to broadcast the Lions game on Thanksgiving Day. This brought in then a national radio audience, and that was the beginning of the Detroit Lions' sort of traditional Thanksgiving Day game.
In 1966, a second game was added to the Thanksgiving Day television schedule, and then more recently, a third game, which really might be taking the whole thing too far.
By then, you're full of food and drink, and you probably don't need to be stuffed with another football game. But depending on who's playing, you might watch.
As for what happened to Charlie Brown, well, we all know the end of that story. For Here and Now, I'm Karen Given.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd. Happy Thanksgiving. It's Here and Now.